bodiless, deathless genius itself. Why did we call her back again and again and again? Not as if she had been giving a good performance, but as if she had been offering salvation. As we listened to her voice, as we watched her, in her tattered tramp costume, we forgot. And this is the acid test, who she was, and indeed, who we were ourselves. As with all true clowns, for Judy Garland is as fine a clown as she is a singer, she seemed to be neither male nor female, young nor old, pretty nor plain. She has no glamour, only magic. She expressed a few simple, common feelings so purely that they floated about in the dark theater, bodiless, as if detached from any specific personality. The usual way of coming to terms with the tragic messes of Garland's life is to accuse Hollywood and its pressures of agents, studios, and pseudo-realities. Only this can explain how a star so gifted, who had it all, could sink so low. I would rather see each of these sinkings as attempts at descent, at misbegotten ways of growing down. It is as if the world that she never reached kept pulling her into it by means of its usual instruments. Sex and money, dealers and lovers, brokers and contracts, marriages and failures. Down, down even to testifying in a murder trial, and her final scene of death on a toilet during the night of June 21st, 22nd. The apogee of the solar year, its brightest moment and shortest night. Where most of the population never make it, in the Garland sense, and dream lifelong of becoming stars, or just of touching one once, the reverse in Garland's case is striking. She wanted to enter the regular world, to live with a man in a stable marriage, to have children. She had three, but in her 40s said wistfully, "I suppose it's too late for me to have another child." To have friends, and not only fans. What kept her going was none of these normalcies, but the ruthlessness of her calling, which opposed them. The standard modern dilemma of home versus work, family versus career, takes on, in Garland's case, the archetypal dimension of a cross, preventing her calling from growing down into life. The vertical dimension stretched between hellish suffering and heavenly miracles, unable to settle into the flat and level of the daily world. Her star was never quite born. Hollywood magnified the calling, demanding that her life comply wholly with her other world's acorn, for which Hollywood acts as collective agent. It expected her life to take care of itself, but Frances Gumm did not know how to keep house, be married, raise children, cook a meal, or make anything with her hands. She could not even find the right clothes to put on. James Mason, who was her leading man in A Star Is Born, said at her funeral, "She who gave so much and richly needed to be repaid. She needed devotion and love beyond the resources of any of us." An inhuman demand. The need of the inhuman for a human world. Garland gave this account of the dilemma her acorn posed. "Maybe it's because I made a certain sound, a musical sound, a sound that seems to belong to the world. But it also belongs to me, because it comes from within me." We are back to a general principle. The heart's image requires efforts of attachment to every sort of anchoring circumstance, whether these anchors be the loyalty of friends, the stability of contracts, the reliability of health, the schedules of the clock, the facts of geography. Because the sound seems to belong to the world and comes through as an invisible gift, there can never be enough world in which to sink its roots. Why do stars sink so low, becoming commercial, face-lifted drunks, sex freaks, religious paranoids? Are these not desperate attempts to touch the common ground? Every symptom is a compromise, as Freud saw. Symptoms attempt the right aim, but accomplish it in the wrong way. The heights seek the depths. One way or another, they want to come down, even if by suicide, by ruinous contracts and bankruptcy, by entangling emotional messes. No soft landings. "The middle road was never for her," said Garland's daughter, Liza Minnelli, at the funeral. Loneliness and exile. The Judy Garland story tells of solitude in the midst of world acclaim. How do we account for the loneliness that accompanies every life? Loneliness is not specific to stars in huge Hollywood houses or reserved for aged seniors in nursing homes. Loneliness belongs to childhood, too. That loneliness in a child's heart may be aggravated by fears of the dark, punishing parents, or rejecting comrades. Its source, however, seems to be the solitary uniqueness of each daimon, an archetypal loneliness inexpressible in a child's vocabulary, and formulated hardly better in ours. Moments of dejection drop us into a pool of loneliness. Waves of intense loneliness occur as aftershocks of childbirth, of divorce, of the death of a long-lived partner. The soul pulls back, mourns alone. Twinges of loneliness accompany even a marvelous birthday celebration and a victorious accomplishment. Are these mere hangovers, compensatory falls after unusual heights? Nothing seems to hold against the drop. All the networking that has interlaced our extension outward and downward into the world, family, friends, neighbors, lovers, little routines, and the results of years of work, seem to count for nothing. We feel ourselves curiously depersonalized, very far away, exiled, no connection anywhere. The spirit of loneliness has taken over. To guard against these moments, we have philosophies that explain them, and pharmaceuticals that deny them. The philosophies say the uprooted and hurried condition of modern city life and impersonal work have created a social condition of enemy. We are isolated because of the industrial economic system. We have become mere numbers. We live consumerism rather than community. Loneliness is symptomatic of victimization. We are victims of a wrong way of life. We should not be lonely. Change the system. Live in a cooperative or a commune, work in a team, or build relationships. Connect, only connect. Socialize, join recovery groups, get involved. Pick up the phone, or ask your doctor for a prescription for Prozac. Deeper than social philosophy and social remedy is the account of moral theology. It recognizes in loneliness the sin of the fall. We are cut off from Eden and from God, owing to the original sin of humankind. When we feel alone and lost in the valley, we are stray sheep that have wandered from the path of redemption. Out of grace and out of faith, and therefore out of hope, we can no longer hear the call of the shepherd, or obey the bark of his persistently nipping dog, hounding our conscience with guilt. We are alone purposely, in order to hear the still small voice whose whispering is drowned out by the madding crowd. Even worse, loneliness is evidence of damnation for our personal sins committed in the corruptible body of flesh. Of course, Judy Garland was homeless, needy, broke, and lonely. These are the wages of sin. Moral theology from the East considers the suffering of isolation to be the task imposed on this life by past karmic actions in another incarnation, or as a preparation for the next. Moral theologies, whether Eastern or Western, subtly transform the sense of loneliness into the sin of loneliness, exacerbating its unhappiness. Grin and bear it, or repent. Existentialism, another way of accounting for loneliness, accepts the suffering of isolation as basic to its theory of human existence. Heidegger, or Camus, for instance, places the human being into the situation of thrownness. We are merely thrown into being here, Dasein. The German word for thrown, Wurf, combines senses of the throw of the dice, a projection, and a litter of pups or piglets cast by a bitch or sow. Life is your project. There is nothing to tell you what it's all about, which of course leaves you feeling existential anxiety and dread. It's all up to you, each individual alone, since there is no cosmic guarantee that anything makes sense. There is neither God nor Godot to wait for. You make a life out of the deepest feelings of meaninglessness. The heroic ability to turn loneliness into individual strength is the way that Judy Garland failed to find. She was too dependent, too weak, too fearful to combine solitary and solidary, a motto proposed by Camus in one of the tales collected in his aptly titled work, the exile, and the kingdom. Garland's desperation demonstrates the truth of existential nihilism. Such would be the existentialist reading. These ways of thinking about loneliness, social, therapeutic, moral, existential, make two assumptions that I cannot accept. First, each says that loneliness equates with literal aloneness, and consequently is remediable by some sort of human action, such as repenting for sins, therapeutic relating, building the project of your life with your own heroic hands. Second, each assumes that loneliness is fundamentally unpleasant. But if there is an archetypal sense of loneliness accompanying us from the beginning, then to be alive is also to feel lonely. Loneliness comes and goes apart from the measures we take. It does not depend on being literally alone, for pangs of loneliness can strike in the midst of friends, in bed with a lover, at the microphone before a cheering crowd. When feelings of loneliness are seen as archetypal, they become necessary. They are no longer harbingers of sin, of dread, or of wrong. We can accept the strange autonomy of the feeling and free loneliness from identification with literal isolation. Nor is loneliness mainly unpleasant once it receives its archetypal background. When we look, or rather feel, closely into the sense of loneliness, we find it is composed of several elements: nostalgia, sadness, silence, and a yearning imagination for something else not here, not now. For these elements and images to show, we first have to focus on them rather than on remedies for being left literally alone. Desperation grows worse when we seek ways out of despair. These conditions of nostalgia, sadness, silence, and a yearning imagination are the stuff of Judy Garland's songs, her voice and phrasing, her body language, her face and eyes. No wonder her performances reach the common heart as no others did. Nostalgia, sadness, silence, and imaginative yearning are also the inmost stuff of religious and romantic poetry in many languages and many cultures. They remind the acorn of its origins. Like E.T. in the Spielberg film, the acorn seems nostalgic, sad, silent, and filled with yearning for an image of home. Loneliness presents the emotions of exile. The soul has not been able to fully grow down and is wanting to return. To where? We do not know, for that place, the myths and cosmology say, is gone from memory. But the imaginative yearning and the sadness attest to an exile from what the soul cannot express except as loneliness. All it can recall is a nostalgia of feeling and an imagination of yearning and a condition of want beyond personal needs. Therefore, when we look again at Judy Garland, we can begin to understand why, even when she was hardly able to find the words or hit the notes, the crowd called for those lyrics, "Somewhere Over the Rainbow," and for the song's last yearning question, "Why can't I?" We can begin to understand as well how Garland was able to keep her fans and professional admirers, despite the shaming collapses and infuriating, erratic petulance of drunken, drugged, messed up Frances Gumm. She made each of her listeners aware of what they, too, most intimately were longing for, the awakened image in the heart of the exiled, and its yearning for what was not in this world. We can also read again the last phases of her life as conditions appropriate to exile, like that of a wanderer on the road, a vagrant or a pilgrim, a member of the diaspora, a Sufi poet beggar, or a wine-drunk Zen monk. The daimon's home is not on the earth. It lives in an altered state. The body's frailty is a basic precondition of the soul's life on earth. And don't we each leave the world with debts unpaid? Drop the sociology and the psychoanalysis, and Garland stands among the few who could never fully grow down, because it was her acorn not only to sing and dance in the theatrical spotlight, to be the magical child, and enact the other world's presence as the white-faced clown, but also to be the representative of exile and its longing. Stardom 2, Josephine Baker. Another equally miraculous woman, whose movement down the Kabbalistic tree took a different course, was born in St. Louis Social Evil Hospital in 1906, also in June. From this degraded entry into the world, she first had to rise to the stars before she could begin her remarkable downward course. As Frances Gumm bore the genius of Judy Garland, Frieda J. McDonald, or Tumpy, as she was called as a child, bore Josephine Baker. This, too, was a woman of fascination and extravagance. Josephine Baker burst into the world at the Theater of the Champs-Élysées, Elysian Fields of Heavenly Paradise, in Paris in October 1925, nude but for a few feathers. The motions of her frenzied, dancing body gave all of Paris a hard-on. She was then 19. By 13, she had already been married. That first husband, a steelworker, was earning, but Josephine spent every penny he brought home on dresses. As the success following the Paris opening brought in money, her dresses expanded. Now she had dogs she traveled with, a monkey on her shoulder, an ostrich cart. She loved cars, although she could not drive. Among those she owned was a rare and expensive Bugatti. In January 1928, she and her manager left Paris for Vienna, taking along, besides hangers-on, lovers and relatives, a secretary, a chauffeur, a maid, a typewriter, two dogs, 196 pairs of shoes, assorted dresses and furs, 64 kilos of face powder, and 30,000 publicity shots for the fans. The body into which her soul descended was one thing, its early circumstances quite different. Scarce food, bedbugs, sleeping on the floor with a dog, hired out as a child to work where she and a dog shared the same food and fleas. The woman she worked for beat her and kept her naked because clothes cost too much. Still a child, she was pawned off to another house to work and sleep with a white-haired old man. That she'd gotten this far was already an accomplishment. Records of the health department in St. Louis show that 3 out of 5 children died before the age of 3. She was dancing even then in a basement where she had set up a little stage and box benches. She slapped the other kids around so they would sit still and pay attention while she performed. She spent every minute she could watching performances at the local clubs and halls and hung around the show people when they came through. Once, she carried a snake into a funeral where the coffin lay open. The snake got loose and panicked the mourners. The coffin tipped over. The corpse rolled, and the snake was bashed to death by the angry people. Tumpy, or was it already Josephine, protector of animals, screamed, "You've killed my friend!" It's not so unusual for children to feel an animal's soul. Yet we also should recall that the snake is perhaps the most ancient and universal carrier of the genius spirit, the figure of a protective guardian, the genius itself. Had she already made friends with her acorn? Finally, one more extravagant tale of Josephine. In Stockholm, she played before the king. But if you asked me how he looked, I couldn't tell you. When I dance, I dance. I don't look at anyone, not even a king. Crown Prince Gustav Adolf, then a young man of 28, was also present. The Crown Prince invited Josephine to the palace and led her through a secret door into a room with a 4-poster bed covered in precious furs. She lay down naked, and the prince summoned a servant who came in with a silver tray heaped with jewels. And one by one, the prince covered Josephine's body with diamonds, emeralds, rubies. This story is, by now, part of the country's folklore. Josephine Baker's star life shows many similarities to that of Judy Garland. The huge public acclaim and the public eclipse, the mesmerizing performances, the need to be in love, the struggle with men as lovers, partners, and exploiters. One young man shot himself right in front of her and died at her feet. Money running through her fingers. The show business whirl and its glamorizing effect on personal habits and health, the ascent from nowhere, the complete lack of a normal education, obsessions with physical inferiorities, Garland worried over her weight and build, Baker over her hair, and sex. Sexual relations were essential to Josephine Baker's performances. She did it in the wings, standing up before going on, with every dance partner, gay or not, with big shots who paid, with the famous, with everyone she wanted, wherever she wanted, whenever she wanted. Once she lay on the floor of her stateroom to entice an indifferent co-dancer. "Look at my body. All the world is in love with that body. Why are you so arrogant?" The writer Georges Simenon, creator of the detective Maigret, and one of Baker's innumerable lovers, as she was one of his mille et trois, described the secret of this body, its particular croupe. In French, croupe means a horse's hindquarters, a rump, hips. Josephine's croupe, Simenon tells his readers, is the sexiest in the world. Why? By God, it's obvious that croupe has a sense of humor. Garland's biographers indicate some of the same compulsive eroticism. The main similarity lies in both women's ability to fascinate, to represent a transcendent aspect of the human soul that calls to each soul in the audience. It is as if they can show off the daimon, let it be seen and heard. Garland's daimon was Over the Rainbow, Baker's La Danse du Sauvage. The parallels part. Josephine Baker grows down. This movement must not be explained away by her down and dirty act, her down and out childhood, the downfall of her career, or by the easy racist explanation that, since she was black, down was her way. She was not put down, nor did she fall down. Josephine Baker grew down. She moved step by step into the political and social world. First, it was the war that began in 1939. She was then 32. She wanted to do all she could for her adopted country, France. This meant risking her life for the French underground by smuggling information, hidden in musical scores, across the borders of France and Spain into Portugal. Being black, she was banned from the theater and was in danger of deportation, even execution. In Morocco, where she was kept royally by relatives of the ruling family, she worked at saving Jews from roundups. For a while, she wore a yellow Star of David on her coat, a far cry from pink plumes. During the cold winter after the liberation of Paris, she scavenged hundreds of pounds of meat, bags of vegetables, and coal to help the poor. She was awarded the Légion d'honneur and the Croix de Guerre for her contributions, and was congratulated by de Gaulle. The next step down was her return to America, where she began to align herself with her St. Louis circumstances. She was an early participant in the civil rights movement. She insisted blacks be hired as stagehands. She joined the 1963 March on Washington. She visited black inmates in a New Jersey prison. For her efforts on behalf of integration, she was praised by Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Bunche. She also visited Castro's Cuba. The FBI's file on her ran to 1,000 pages. Baker's last step down was supporting 11 adopted children from many nations and of many colors, fighting to keep them together, and to see they were fed, housed, and schooled. She toured and performed, appealing for funds to hold on to the country estate that was their home, and into which she had sunk her last money. Saved once by Grace Kelly, and another time by Brigitte Bardot, finally she was foreclosed and physically thrown out in the rain, broke, homeless, aging, she gave her last show to wild acclaim in Paris a few days before she died, April 12, 1975, at the Salpêtrière Hospital. Her death there recapitulated her birth at the St. Louis Social Evil Hospital, for the Salpêtrière had been built for outcast women, prostitutes, syphilitics, indigents, criminals. Rise and fall. It is one of the archetypal patterns of life, and one of its most ancient cosmic lessons. But how one falls, the style of coming down, remains the interesting part. Judy Garland's was a heroic and sad decline into collapse. Her efforts aimed at the comeback, she tried again and again to connect with the upper world of stardom, a struggle that ironically led to that dismal death in a London flat. The 30-minute ovation Josephine Baker received in Paris that final week was both for the daimon in her body, the people did not want to leave the theater, and for her long and slow history of growing down into this world of social evils, fascism, racism, abandonment of children, injustice. The Platonic myth of growing down with which we began this chapter says the soul descends in four modes, via the body, the parents, place, and circumstances. These four ways can be instructions for completing the image you brought with you on arrival. First, your body. Growing down means going with the sag of gravity that accompanies aging. Baker told people she was 64 while she was still in her mid-50s. She wore old clothes and gave up covering her baldness. Second, admitting yourself to be one among your people and a member of the family tree, including its twisted and rotten branches. Third, living in a place that suits your soul and that ties you down with duties and customs. Last, giving back what circumstances gave you by means of gestures that declare your full attachment to this world. Chapter 3. The Parental Fallacy. If any fantasy holds our contemporary civilization in an unyielding grip, it is that we are our parents' children, and that the primary instrument of our fate is the behavior of your mother and father. As their chromosomes are ours, so are their mess-ups and attitudes. Their joint unconscious psyche, the rages they suppress, the longings they cannot fulfill, the images they dream at night, basically form our souls, and we can never, ever work through and be free of this determinism. The individual soul continues to be imagined as a biological offspring of the family tree. We grow psychologically out of their minds as our flesh grows biologically out of their bodies. If sharp definitions of parenting and parents have begun to melt owing to the infiltrations of law, demographics, and biochemistry, the idea of parenting and parents is more hardened than ever in the minds of moral reformers and psychotherapists. The shibboleth, family values expressed by catchphrases like bad mothering and absent fathering, trickles down into family systems therapy, which has become the single most important set of ideas determining the theory of societal dysfunction and the practice of mental health. Yet all along, a little elf whispers another tale. You are different. You're not like anyone in the family. You don't really belong. There is an unbeliever in the heart. It calls the family a fantasy, a fallacy. Even the biological model has puzzling gaps. Contraception is easier to account for and practice than conception itself. What goes on in that massive, virginly intact, single, round ovum that allows only this particular minuscule sperm among millions to enter? Or is the question more correctly addressed to the sperm? Is one of you more wily, more pushy, and more sympathetically congenial? Or is it just the randomness of luck? And what is luck, really? We know about DNA and the results of joinings, but we are left with the mystery that Darwin spent a life with, the mystery of selection. The acorn theory suggests a primitive solution. It says, your diamond selected both the egg and the sperm, as it selected their carriers, called parents. Their union results from your necessity, and not the other way around. Does this not help to understand the impossible unions, those antipathies and misalliances, the quick conceptions and sudden desertions occurring between the parents of so many of us, and especially in the biographies of the eminent? The couple came together, not for their personal unity, but to beget the unique person, endowed with a specific acorn, who turns out to be you. Take, for instance, the tale of Thomas Wolfe, that gigantic, verbose, romantic, smoky mountain novelist born October 3, 1900. The parents of Wolfe, says his biographer Andrew Turnbull, were joined in an epic misalliance. Two people more temperamentally unsuited could scarcely be imagined. The father was lavish, sensual, expansive. The mother, flinty, parsimonious, repressed. How did they ever get together? Some 16 years before Thomas Wolfe's arrival on Earth, his mother, Julia Westall, age 24, country schoolteacher, came into the shop of once divorced, once widowed, W. O. Wolfe, a marble cutter who made tombstones. She came a-calling to sell books, her moonlighting way of picking up the extra penny. Having glanced at the book she was selling, he put his name down for it. Then he asked if she ever read novels. Oh, I read most everything, she answered. Not the Bible as much as I should, though. W.O. said he owned some fine love stories, and that afternoon he sent her Augusta Jane Evans' St. Elmo. A few days later, when Julia was starting out to sell another book, W.O. pressed her to stay for lunch, after which he took her into the parlor and showed her his stereopticon slides of the Civil War. He took her hand, said he had been watching her for quite a while as she passed his shop, and proposed. Julia protested that they barely knew each other. W.O. was so adamant, however, that she finally said she would open the book she was selling at random and abide by the middle paragraph of the right-hand page. Just a bit of foolishness on my part, she remembered long afterwards, and hit on a description of a wedding with the words, "Till death do us part." "Oh, that's it," cried W.O. "That's the very thing. We're going to let it stand." The wedding took place in January, a scant 3 months after his headlong proposal. Many explanations for this sudden misalliance. Opposites attract, youth and age, simple utility, she needed an economic foothold, he needed a housekeeper, sadomasochistic compulsion, reenactment of parental dramas, societal pressures on the single. Are you convinced? Why not at least entertain that they met through the book? She approached him proposing a book. He countered sending her a book. It was decided by opening a book, and they brought forth, as fruit of their bookish union, Thomas Wolfe, writer of books. When he was 2, it was a parental parlor trick to have him read aloud for guests. Julia believed she had invisibly brought about his literary ability, for during her pregnancy she had spent the afternoons reading in bed. As for Wolfe's 6 living brothers and sisters, they had other acorns, which choose those parents for other proclivities. Again, it is mainly in the exceptional that the acorn shows itself most clearly. So Thomas Wolfe was called to that household in Asheville, North Carolina, and his parents were called to each other to make that household so that he could do what had to be done. How else could he have done what he did, had he not known his parents before they knew him? An angel's finger opened the page, conceiving them to be his parents, before they conceived him, their child. Mothers. Julia Wolfe believed in her determining influence on her son Tom, and I wouldn't ever contest the impression of a mother's character, whatever it be, makes upon her natural-born child. She is so indubitably there that it needs no argument, no affirmative evidence. So a whole step in this discussion can be bypassed. As the mathematician G.H. Hardy said, a serious man ought not to waste time stating a majority opinion. Let us then put mother behind us, as she is always behind us anyway, a great silent idol center stage against which the biographies in this book take place. As for the power in this idol, and our idolatrous worship of it, let me repeat an oft-told tale. Identical twin men, now age 30, were separated at birth and raised in different countries by their respective adoptive parents. Both kept their lives neat, neat to the point of pathology. Their clothes were preened, appointments met precisely on time, hands scrubbed regularly to a raw red color. When the first was asked why he felt the need to be so clean, his answer was plain. My mother. When I was growing up, she always kept the house perfectly ordered. She insisted on every little thing returned to its proper place. The clocks, we had dozens of clocks, each set to the same noonday chime. She insisted on this, you see. I learned from her. What else could I do? The man's identical twin, just as much a perfectionist with soap and water, explained his own behavior this way. The reason is quite simple. I'm reacting to my mother, who was an absolute slob. How shall we arrange the 3 components of this tale? The facts of perfectionism, the theory of reactive causality, and the myth of mother. Proponents of innate geneticism might claim that this tale is superb anecdotal evidence for the dominating role of heredity. Advocates of the importance of earthly environment might still claim that, indeed, the 2 men reacted to their mothers, but in 2 different ways, one in accord, the other in opposition, and that their mothers indeed were the crucial influence in forming their obsessiveness. For me, this tale illustrates myth substituting for theory and accounting for facts. For let's not overlook that what the identical twins have in common besides their perfectionism is their identical theory of that perfectionism, their mutual assertion that mother is behind it all. The myth of mother in our culture carries the higher dignity and force of theory, and we are a nation of mother lovers in the support we give her by adhering to the theory. If we can so readily accept the mother myth, then why not another myth, a different myth? The Platonic one this book proposes. It cannot be the resistance to myth that makes us balk at the acorn theory, since we so gullibly swallow the myth of mother. The reason we resist the myth of the daimon, I believe, is that it comes clean. It is not disguised as empirical fact. It states itself openly as a myth. Furthermore, it challenges us to recognize our individuality as a birthright, without the fallback pillow of mother as comforting ground and archetypal support. As nuclear one-on-one motherhood wanes, the myth hangs in there, clutching at the archetypal breast. We still believe in mom, even as we watch everything change. Daycare centers, spread-out families, daddies doing diapers, homeless kids caring for younger siblings, teenage mothers of two or three kids, 45-year-old mothers of their first. It's all changing. Demographics, economics, legal definitions of parenthood, conceptions, adoptions, drugs, diagnoses, guidance books. Nonetheless, the myth of the mother as the dominant in everyone's life remains constant, for behind each birth giver and care provider sits the universal Great Mother, upholding the universe of that belief system I'm calling the parental fallacy, which keeps us bonded to her. She appears shaped by the style of your personal mother. And she is as bad as she is good, smothering, nourishing, punishing, devouring, ever-giving, obsessive, hysterical, morose, loyal, easygoing. Whatever her character, she too has a daimon, but her fate is not yours. Yet biography loves mothers. It loves to tell of marvelous or malevolent mothers as the agents of destiny behind men and women of eminence. Cole Porter, carrying his mother's name, Kate Cole Porter, also carried her own lifelong dream to become a professional musician. She saw to it that the little boy of 8 performed, and at 10 traveled 30 miles by train for his music lessons. Frank Lloyd Wright's mother knew exactly that her son was to be an architect, and, say the biographers, influenced him in that direction by hanging pictures of buildings in her baby's room. It was to cheer his depressed mother that James Barry began the ad hoc storytelling that led to his writing inventions like Peter Pan. Pablo Casals, one of 11 children in a poor family in a Catalan village, was taken by his mother to Barcelona, some 40 miles away, to go on with his music. And until Pablo was 22, the home was fragmented, burdened, impoverished by the weight of the mother's consuming drive to see the talent of her son actualized and recognized. One day, the mother of Edward Teller, the physicist hawk of nuclear arms, was walking in a Budapest park, heavy with her unborn child. Her companion asked why her pace had slowed and why she was studying the landscape. Teller's mother replied, "I have a feeling this time it will be a son, and I'm sure he will be famous. So I'm looking for the best site to build his monument." Our usual psychology says Teller was pushed to fame by his mother. But why not imagine that Ilona Teller intuitively picked up on the daimon inhabiting her womb? Krishnamurti, the philosopher teacher, lost his mother when he was still a boy, but he frequently saw her after she died. "I remember once following my mother's form as it went upstairs. I saw the vague form of her dress and part of her face. This happened almost always when I went out of the house." Krishnamurti's sighting of his mother's form demonstrates clearly the blending of the memorial mother, her actual being, and the spirit of the mother, her daimon, which often merges with or participates with the daimon of the child, even as it grows into majority and eminence. It is the rare mother who can see the seed, encourage its emergence, and yet not mess with its individual direction. Van Cliburn, the master pianist, was taught music by his mother. she makes clear the distinction between mentoring the spirit and mothering the child. With the realization of Anne's unusual gifts, our relationship while at work became that of teacher and pupil, rather than mother and child. From the outset, I cautioned young Van against showing off, reminding him that his ability was a divine gift for which he should be deeply grateful, without taking undue credit for himself. Clyburn confirms this. From age 3, she gave me a piano lesson every day of my life, every single day. We'd sit down to the piano and she'd say, "Now just forget I'm your mother. I'm your piano teacher. And we must be very serious." The greatness of the mother's power is indisputable, especially when it can recognize and defend, and, as in cases like Clyburn's, serve to instruct her child's daimon. The daimon, however, predates the mother, maybe even predetermines the mother, or at least so says the acorn theory. For little Van was already a musician by the age of 2. He had picked up by ear, simply by listening to lessons going on in another room, a complex little number that required crossing left hand over the right with tricky rests and syncopations. And so the acorn theory says also that his daimon chose just the right mother, one who knew what to do with a wunderkind. Would young Clyburn from Kilgore, Texas, have gone to Moscow, knocking the judges dead, and winning the International Tchaikovsky Piano Competition, had he been born, say, to your mother, or raised in your house? But is eminence caused by the mother? Do mothers create their children as they carry them, bringing their spirits to birth as they bring their bodies to term? If we do not differentiate her daimon from her child's, then mother must also be declared a monster maker, whose daimon or demon lives out its life in her physical child. Hitler, Mao, Nasser of Egypt were deeply attached to their mothers. Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana was lifted out of village life and given a Western education because of the persuasion of his mother. Whether a charismatic leader is actually seen into and helped by a mother, or whether a leader needs to believe in the mother myth, which he honors by tribute to a personal mother, cannot be ascertained. But somehow the mother myth likes big dictators. Woodrow Wilson, Harry Truman, Dwight D. Eisenhower, Lyndon Johnson, Richard M. Nixon, they too were favored by, or favored their mothers. Remember Nixon, confused and broken, leaving the White House in disgrace, paying maudlin tribute to his mother in that last speech. My mother, once meeting Sarah Delano Roosevelt, Franklin D.'s mother, was asked how many children she had. My mother answered, 4, to which the senior Mrs. Roosevelt replied, "I had only one, but he did very well." And Sarah Delano Roosevelt saw to it that he did, perhaps noticing his genius very early, following it, or pushing it every difficult step of the way as long as she lived. What about those mothers who had no understanding of their children's calling and misperceived their natures? And what about the eminent people who fought with mother, hating her mind, her habits, and her values? Differences of this sort seem to make no dent in the parental fallacy. The myth still holds whether mother gave positive, unconditional support or lived her life in selfish, narcissistic indifference. Biographies twist contrary facts toward the same end, which shows that biographers, including ourselves in our own accounts of why we are as we are, remain as enthralled by the parental fallacy as were those twins who stated that mother was the reason for their raw red hands. George Lukács, a Hungarian Marxist writer and influential critic, was at odds with his mother from the start. In the last year of his life, 1971, he still remembered her unkindly. All along, he had refused to extend her even formal courtesy. Lukács wrote, "At home, absolute alienation. Above all, mother, almost no communication. Because she was conventional, shallow, and mainly interested in social life, Lukács's biography connects his Marxist sympathy for the oppressed and his anti-bourgeois rebelliousness with this antagonism to his mother. The acorn theory, of course, regards his mother as necessary for his genius. He needed an enemy within the walls who represented the values his daimon innately abhorred. Very early I was ruled by feelings of strong opposition." This kind of radical opposition to the conventional mother appears in the biographies of the composer Igor Stravinsky, for instance, and the photographer Diane Arbus. Stravinsky's mother chided her son for not recognizing his betters, like Scriabin, and she did not hear Le Sacre du Printemps, one of the path-breaking works of the century, until its 25th anniversary performance a year before she died. Even then, she told friends she did not expect to like it, that he did not write her kind of music. Gertrude, the mother of Diane Arbus, was concerned about her children. Like any good mother, she wanted them only to do the right thing, the correct thing, and to have all the advantages. Arbus was an original outsider, a portrayer of freaks, who eventually killed herself. Stravinsky lived a long, extraordinarily productive life, composing not his mother's kind of music. Stravinsky and Arbus strayed far from their mother's narrow path. But we may not claim it was that path which forced them so far out. We may not assume that a conventional mother produces a freaky child, any more than that a freaky child produces a conventional mother, or that a wild and woolly mother produces a normal child. As researchers report, all sorts of mothers have all sorts of offspring. The two generations cannot be tied together by a neat knot. Mothers and children may worship at very different altars and serve very different gods, even if they are placed all day long in the same family. No matter how close physically, they may have immensely different fates. Roy Cohn, one of those sleazy, clever power pushers who slide to the forefront throughout history, received protective, conventional parenting. My parents were forever trying to provide me with a normal childhood. Summer camp, Park Avenue apartment, the Horace Mann School, Columbia Law. An only child, Cohn lived, traveled, and kept company with his mother, Muddy, until she died when he was 40. Throughout, she looked out for him, a careful, watchful, accommodating mother who called her son the child. The normal child she sought became a notoriously shady mess. Hannah Arendt's mother, too, was caring and watchful, keeping a diary of observations of and reflections upon Hannah's behavior from birth well into the teen years. She restrained Hannah from sitting up too soon and from freely moving her legs, swaddling her, as was the custom, in a vikeltepik, or wrapping rug. She fostered her daughter's education in every respect, two closely attentive mothers attempting to give their children the best, yet Cohn turned out ruthless, vain, and amoral, while Arendt became one of the leading moral philosophers of this age, friend of Karl Jaspers, lover of Martin Heidegger. She remained a sunshine child with a genius for friendship and a principled commitment to neighborly love, an idea that lies at the heart of her enduring thought. Then there is the neglectful mother. My mother used to put a pillow on the floor and give me one toy and just leave me there, said Barbara McClintock. Later, her overburdened mother sent her daughter out of state to live with relatives. Edna St. Vincent Millay's mother, a nurse, yanked her daughter out of eighth grade after a dispute with the principal. Edna had been doing excellently in school and enjoyed her friends, but now she was left alone at home all day and often at night while her mother worked. Tina Turner said, I had no love for my mother or my father from the beginning. Alienation, rejection. I didn't know those words. I just knew I couldn't communicate with my mother. And that was the beginning for me. I didn't have anybody, no foundation in life, so I had to discover my mission in life. Though neglected by the mothers, these children were not left alone by their daimons, which proved to be their foundations. For it was solitude that McClintock and Millay needed for their callings, and neglect that Turner required to discover hers. These acorns evidently picked mothers of the neglecting kind to provide the right environment for these young girls. Whether their subject receives support from the mother, Casals, Wright, Roosevelt, or has differences with the mother, Lukács, Arbus, Stravinsky, or is neglected by the mother, McClintock, Millay, Turner, biographers tend to enlarge mother with mythical greatness, confusing the power of her archetypal image with the force of the individual acorn. Deconstructing the parents. The parental fallacy depends largely on this fantasy of one-way vertical causality, from larger to smaller, from older to younger, from experienced to inexperienced. Yet, just as actual motherhood is waning in the face of social changes that alter its conventions, so the theory of mother's importance is being undermined by evidence against vertical causality within families. Another twice-told tale. This one reports the behavior of a family of rhesus monkeys on an unpopulated Japanese island, where researchers left fresh sweet potatoes on the beach. Emo spat out the sand clinging to her sweet potato, put it into the sea, and rubbed it vigorously with her free hand. She ate the cleaned potato, enjoying its salty taste. Nearby, Nimby watched and thrust her potato into the sea. She didn't get all the sand off, but it still tasted better than ever before. The two young playmates' example taught others. Soon their age mates, both male and female, had caught on to the potato washing routine. Emo's mother also learned, and soon was teaching potato washing to Emo's younger siblings. Emo's father, though he enjoyed a reputation for toughness and leadership, was too stubborn to try the new trick. The researcher David Rowe wants us to see that innovation and the transmission of ideas take place in various ways: horizontally within the family, sibling to sibling, vertically but reciprocally, child to mother and mother to child, outside the family as young monkeys learn from one another. Some, the old males, seem not to learn at all, or at least not about washing potatoes. But one crucial question is not asked. How did Emo get the idea? How come she washed that first potato? What prompted that bit of behavior? Her daimon, of course, which inspired the whole event to begin with. And also the oft-told report. Emo's genius continues to teach you and me by means of this story. Yes, animals too have angels. As far back as we can imagine cultural history, it was widely believed that animals were the first teachers. Our earliest language, our dances, our rituals, our knowledge of what to eat and what not to eat passed into our behavior through theirs. Suspicion of vertical causality, particularly suspicion of the mother as primary factor in determining fate, comes from another direction as well. Diane Eyer calls mother-infant bonding, which gives her book its title, a scientific fiction, her subtitle. Bonding is, in fact, as much an extension of ideology as it is a scientific discovery. More specifically, it is part of an ideology in which mothers are seen as the prime architects of their children's lives and are blamed for whatever problems befall them, not only in childhood, but throughout their adult lives. Later in her book, Eyer says, "I would like to urge the impossible, that we discard the word bonding entirely, which would force us to notice that children are not merely putty in our hands. They are born with vastly different personalities and capabilities." Eyer's scientific fiction is my parental fallacy. Her perception of children's vastly different personalities is my vision of uniquely distinct acorns. Far more than parents shape our lives. Children are profoundly affected by an array of people who interact with them, by the foods they eat, by the music they hear, by the television they watch, by the hope they see in the adult world. People can connect with each other intellectually, emotionally, through daily caretaking, through games, through music and art, through formal learning, and from long distances. There are many, many dimensions to the nurturance of our children. Eyer's net of nurturance could be cast wider, to include the spiritual and religious phenomena arising autonomously in children and reported in detail by Robert Coles. Also to be included are the machineries and interiors that children live within, the streets and their sounds, the explanations and values taught them, and the invisibles displayed by nature. All this not only provides children with stimulation and input, all this also expresses the meaning of the world to which each of them must respond. That some respond in unexpected ways, or refuse to respond at all, cannot logically be attributed to insecurities and disturbances in their tie with parents. For any one of us, child or adult, the question eclipsing all others is, How does what comes with you to the world find a place in the world? How does my meaning fit with the meanings to which I am asked to conform? What helps growing down? The parental fallacy does not help anyone grow down. It pulls us away from the acorn and back to mom and dad, who may already be dead and gone, though we remain stuck with their effects. I am then a mere effect myself, a result of their causes. For all our heroic individualism, America still clings to a mother-based developmental psychology that states we are fundamentally results of parenting and, as such, fundamentally victims of what happened in the past and left indelible stains. Psychologically, as a nation, we seem ever to be trying to put the past behind us, trying to recover from past abuses. Perhaps recovery begins only when we have put the mother myth behind us. For we are less the victims of parenting than of the ideology of parenting, less the victims of mother's fateful power than of the theory that gives her that fateful power. John Bowlby's immensely influential Child Care and the Growth of Love states that theory. An archetypal voice of the great mother sounds through it, with dire warnings of evil and death if the theory be unheeded, the mother's power dishonored. The evidence is now such that it leaves no room for doubt regarding the general proposition that the prolonged deprivation of a young child of maternal care may have grave and far-reaching effects on his, sick, character, and so on the whole of his future life. It is a proposition exactly similar in form to those regarding the evil after-effects of German measles before birth or deprivation of vitamin D in infancy. It is not your mother who holds dominion over your adult life, but the ideology that proclaims that each of us has been determined in the first hours after birth, or during birth itself. The ideology that proclaims a series of tiny causes and accumulating effects lead to how you are today and how you will affect your own children. You are the direct cause of damage to their lives, damage resulting not merely in their frustration and failure, but in crimes and madness. This ideology traps women in the parental fallacy and children in mother blame. Iyer's caustic criticism deconstructs this ideology, but her deconstruction is not destructive. Like mine, it aims to dissolve the fallacy that has made bonding a bondage. The fallacy, says David Rowe, is in believing that what forms human nature is a 14-year period of rearing, rather than a heavier weight of cultural history and ultimately human evolutionary roots. In broader terms, cultural traditions can be passed in many ways other than exposure to idealized nuclear families. The adolescents who signed up enthusiastically for Nazi youth groups before World War II did not have souls bent and torn by poor rearing in early childhood. Indeed, their families were stolidly middle class and emotionally supportive. If a nation's youth can be changed by a few years of great cultural change, why emphasize childhood? The elevation of the parents, of the mother in particular, to the neglect of all other realities, societal, environmental, economic, shows that adulation of an archetype can obliterate common sense. Iyer notes that worldwide authorities on mothering, Bowlby and T. Barry Brazelton, attribute the hollow-eyed lassitude and sadness of young children in Cambodia and in post-World War II Europe to the loss of their mothers, and to other disturbances in the mother-child relationships, taking no note of the overwhelming horrors in the world encompassing these mothers and children. Had these children been well bonded with good enough mothers, secure in their attachments, the devastation, genocide, and despair would have been incidental to their deplorable condition. Again, the archetypal myth of the completely surrounding mother, insulating from all influences, prevails over the actual world of collective pain. The mother myth encloses as well the minds of the scientific observers. Mother-based theories comfort and suffocate both. A very different sort of observer, Mary Watkins, points out that the major psychological theorists, D.W. Winnicott, Melanie Klein, René Spitz, John Bowlby, Anna Freud, who lay such stress upon the mother-child relation as the determinant of life, ever after worked out their ideas while bombs were falling and buildings burning in England, or just before and just after World War II. It is not unusual to retreat to the mother when in danger, but must psychoanalyze